You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
From the heart of where innovation, money, and power collide, in Silicon Valley and beyond, this is Bloomberg Technology with Emily Chang.
I'm here in Boston, Massachusetts, big city, right here for a special edition of Bloomberg Technology. We are, of course, broadcasting from the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce here at the Boston Convention and the Exhibit Center. A really wonderful event here. The annual meeting is underway. Coming up in the next hour, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell saying tightening financial conditions, it is just what we need, and they are resolved to curb the highest inflation in decades, including moving more aggressively if need be. We have all the details. Plus, of course, the COVID pandemic reaches dire milestones, the death toll hitting 1 million people in the U.S. What did we learn from the pandemic? What does the post-pandemic world look like, from biotech to education and beyond? We'll discuss it all. And of course, we're going to be taking a look at the future of sports betting. We have a great conversation coming up with the DraftKings CEO, Jason Robins, about his next bet and how they're managing some of those inflation worries. So much more coming up later this hour. I'm so pleased that Natasha Lamb, of course, you know her as the managing partner over here at Arjuna Capital, based just outside Boston, here with me on the set. It is so fun to see you here in person. And what we are just showing on the screen has been this big sort of tech sell-off and the huge volatility we've had in the markets. What are you hearing about some of the jitters going on within the tech markets right now?
Yeah, well, thank you, Taylor. It's really nice to be here. Nice to be in person. I think the tech sector is facing two big headwinds. One is just an upcoming slowdown in economic growth along with inflation. And if you look historically during those times, it's the tech sector that gets hit the hardest. Mm. So that's a big piece. And the other part is interest rates.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you think about technology stocks, we think of them as long duration stocks,
right,
meaning when you're valuing them, you're going out years and years
right,
with cash flows. So when interest rates go up, you discount those cash flows at higher rates, which leads to lower valuation.
I want to talk about that a little bit because there's been a big conversation in the market about valuations. Is it just rethinking higher rates and the lower net present value, or is there something else going on that maybe growth at any cost doesn't work? Maybe that isn't the model anymore. What is the a real issue.
Well, I think that's right. I think companies need a business model, and I'm a big fan of profitability. So I think that that is right. If you look at what's happened to valuations this year, you know, at the beginning of the year, the tech sector was trading near 30 times versus a 10-year average of about 20 times, which I think we can all agree is a more reasonable valuation.
Right.
But when you do have, you know, we've had a lot of growth over the last 3 years. So companies have been in a good position. Now companies are trading a little under the 5-year average. So there's already been a big correction. I think now it's just about positioning yourself for quality, profitability, more stable earnings growth in this environment.
Talk to me about quality, because I think what's interesting in sort of these broader based, I'm hesitant to use the word panic, but we can use that. You get sort of a mass sell-off, and yet Apple pulls in $90 billion of free cash flow a year. Microsoft, really stable companies with strong balance sheets. So when you think about quality, are you still thinking about big tech within that?
Absolutely. And it's really important to be able to discern which companies have that growth, that more stable growth, that higher quality balance sheet, return on equity. And if you look, even if you go back 3 years, because we know the market has, you know, risen dramatically despite the most recent correction, those companies, you know, Apple, Microsoft, Google, they've either doubled or tripled over that time.
Right.
So they've been good investments. They're going to continue to be good investments. But if you then pivot to the social media companies, Facebook, Twitter, you know, they've really gone nowhere in the last 3 years.
Okay, you brought up Twitter. I didn't. So I'm going to go there. I'm going to take the bait. How do you think about Twitter and valuing and investing in a company with some of the maybe take private conversations playing out in public, the volatility that that creates, and a refocus on the business model, how, what percent of the users are bots? How do you think about the fundamentals of that company?
Yeah, I mean, I think Twitter has had so many challenges over the years, which is why you've seen, you know, CEOs come and go, move around, why you're seeing what's happening with Elon Musk right now. You know, unfortunately right now, I feel like Elon Musk is like a cat playing with a ball of string. And, you know, all of these public tweets and, you know, it's really, it's just so uncertain what's going to happen.
Right.
The stock's already given back all of the gains that it had when the you know, takeover was announced. And, you know, it just feels a little manipulative.
Yeah, and that's a strong word when we're thinking about.
Yeah, but I just, like, you know, what is happening with Twitter right now? I think it's quite unfortunate for the company, whether or not Musk buys it.
Right. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't think about that we're here in person for the first time in 2 years. We're coming out of a pandemic. And I think in the middle of the pandemic, we all thought long and hard about ESG.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a panel in a few weeks about the S in ESG, because you can't just blend it together. Within ESG, how do you paint that with a broad brush, or really focus on what is the E, what is the S, what is the G?
Yeah, I think it's really important that you look at all of these issues as their own issues. You know, ESG investing has gone from niche to mainstream. I mean, I've been in this space my whole career, and when I started, it was completely niche. So it's really interesting to see what's happened in this space. But when it comes to, you know, those different pieces, you know, when you're talking about S, some areas that we've really engaged in on the social side are things like racial and gender pay equity.
Right.
Or sexual harassment. And we're seeing, you know, what's changed so dramatically is we're seeing so much support now from institutional investors. So for instance, you know, last November we had a shareholder proposal go to a vote at Microsoft, which is a long-term investment of ours. And we looked at Microsoft and we said, they really need to address this issue head on. And it got a 78% vote of investors. Remarkable.
Right.
Disney on pay equity, a month or two ago, a 60% vote. So you're starting to see mainstream investors, institutional investors really show up because they understand these issues are material. Social issues, your human capital, how you attract and retain and promote talent are really important issues.
I think maybe if there is any criticism of ESG, it's been in the beginning when you think about the E, it was investing in solar power and windmills, and the returns, frankly, weren't necessarily keeping up. How do you make sure that yes, we want to invest in ESG, but the returns also have to be there. Can you have both together?
Absolutely. So, you know, you can look through an ESG lens across all sectors and industries of the economy, and you can choose the companies that are, you know, in that top quartile. And there's been studies that have shown that the companies that manage their environmental, social, and governance risks and opportunities better have actually had a tailwind to performance and have outperformed. So, you know, yeah, if you're going to just put in a clean tech basket or, you know, more things that are more volatile and transformative, there can be ups and downs. We know that in any market. But it's a lens that you want to apply much more broadly, depending on what asset class, what sector. And, you know, we really think about it through kind of three lenses. One, we don't want to invest in things that are just fundamentally bad for people and planet.
Right.
So, like, we're not invested in fossil fuels or private prisons or tobacco. We look to invest in solutions where we can, things like you were talking about, renewable energy.
Right.
But we're also going to invest in companies like Google that are investing in renewable energy in their operations and are more efficient, or, you know, are treating their employees well, companies like that.
Right.
And then we look to engage with companies to, you know, so that they're managing those risks and opportunities better, and it just makes them better companies. It's a win-win.
So much fun to have you here to help kick off a big show. My pleasure. That was Natasha Lamb, Arjuna Capital. Really appreciate your time and your insights here. Welcome back to this very big special edition of Bloomberg Technology. We are live here from the Boston Convention Center for the annual Chamber of Commerce meeting, of course, for the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. I'm so pleased to say that Jason Kelly is sitting right next to me. He is the co-founder and CEO of Ginkgo Bioworks, based right here in Boston. And
yeah,
we were talking off camera, everyone here is an MIT or a Harvard grad. You, of course, are an MIT, one of the smart ones.
Yeah,
talk to us about
it. I did an undergrad and PhD. My dad called it a decade of excellence.
Oh, yeah, there you go. Well, talk to us about your decade of excellence, the company, and how you're thinking about all of this big biotech innovation that's going on, of which you are a part of.
Yeah, I mean, so I think that's one of the great things about the area, frankly, is you have close proximity to these schools. So the founders of the company, there's four MIT PhDs, an MIT professor, and the idea was, you know, take the learnings from software, right? This idea that you can program code, you put it in your phone, put a new app in, make it do something new, apply that in biology. And the idea was, hey, DNA is code. You can read it and write it, and you can sort of install new code in a cell. You can make it do something new. And so that was really the foundation, and it came from our experience at MIT working there.
I think in COVID, we all learned what mRNA was, and a lot of us hadn't heard that before. How has the success of that technology helped bring, I think, light to a lot of the work that you guys are doing, a lot of the innovation going on?
Yeah, so I think it's a huge deal, actually.
Yeah.
Right? You know, like COVID has been basically a general public education on biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
People know what PCR tests are all of a sudden, right? Like, that means something to people. Like, PCR is complete lab nerd town, okay, right? Now it's a common phrase. mRNA, I mean, think about it, right? Like, what we did was we put a piece, you know, what, you know, Moderna and others, put a piece of mRNA code into your body. Your cells read that, execute it, and, you know, put up a little piece of the virus and get your immune system going. Well, that's the beginning of genomic medicine. Right, there are many, many drugs to come now that are going to be actually code delivered to your body to make it do something new. And by the way, the reason this works is that's how your body already works.
Right.
Right. Your cells talk to each other. They exchange in the language of mRNA and DNA. That's how information is passed among generations in biology. We're just finally able to talk their language.
Came into this pandemic and maybe a lot of us felt caught off guard.
Yeah.
How are you thinking about preparing for the next pandemic? The innovation, the technology, the small minor tweaks that you can make to, if there is another one, what does that look like? What does the treatment look like?
Yeah, so I think we got sucker punched, frankly, by COVID, right? And so we had to go out with what we had available to us, right? And so you saw a crash program to see if we could make mRNA vaccines work. Heroic effort, right? Like, really, it's like a moon landing. And so that is now, I think, one of the base. Like, if things get out of control, we have mRNA vaccines as a way to rapidly respond. They won't work for everything, but they'll work for a lot of things. The trick is, how do you stop them from getting out of control?
Right.
And what you need for that is like a weather map. Like where are viruses spreading?
Right.
How can you contain them so you can make targeted interventions, right? I grew up in Florida. We know when a hurricane is coming.
Right.
We board up the windows.
Right.
We prepare. And as a result, several weeks later, life is back to normal. The economy comes back faster. Less people lose their lives. You prepare if you have the information, and you can prepare locally. We don't have any that visibility into where viruses are, and that's what needs to get built.
Right.
And that's starting to happen. We're one of the largest providers of testing in schools in the country, for example.
Right.
You have now thousands of organizations where we're testing. That's to give people that picture.
Broaden this out a little bit. Before your segment, we were speaking with Natasha Lamb, who was taking more of a markets perspective. And there's been a big rethink about valuations at this moment, particularly within the biotech space.
Yeah.
I don't need you to comment on if you think your company's over or undervalued, because we don't know the answer to that.
Yeah.
But how are you thinking about valuations and the fundraising environment in this moment?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the things I think you're seeing is sort of interest rates go up and people get out of long-term growth, right? You know, and that, I think that's very rational, right? And so that doesn't mean long-term growth companies can't be valuable, but I think it means investors need to ask, do they have the capital to get to it, right? To get to that long-term growth they're planning for? And if they do, I think you'll see a consolidation around certain companies that have that, the kind of winners in the space. I think they'll have an easier time raising capital, and a lot of other folks won't. And it kind of reminds me of like 99, 2000 internet, right?
Right.
You had sort of a culling.
Yeah.
But Amazon got built then.
Right.
Frankly, that was when they made a lot of the big fundamental principles of Amazon got built in 99 to 2003 because of an environment like this. So, you know, if you bet on the right ones, I think you could do well.
This is really great. It's like we should do this more often. Jason Kelly, thank you so much. You know him as Ginkgo Bioworks CEO. Really appreciate your time there and your insights. Stay with us, because coming up, still keeping on this sort of COVID theme and all the lessons learned from the pandemic, we're going to be speaking with Wellesley College's president about the challenge of steering students through a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic and, well, the path forward. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice, or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do. The people in the spotlight, athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Boston, welcome back. This is the Boston Chamber of Commerce annual meeting. And I'm really pleased to say, and I want to bring in our next guest, Wellesley President, Dr. Paula Johnson, who is the Boston Chamber's dinner honoree tonight, to really talk about sort of how colleges are coming out of this big pandemic era. And what for you has been some of the biggest key takeaways, all remote, and then, of course, trying to bring some students back?
Yeah, it's been fascinating. And I would say that in Massachusetts, we've done such an amazing job of working together to create the protocols that have been critical to allow us to bring students back to school, which has been so important for our students, not only in terms of learning, but for their mental health.
And it's interesting that you talk about mental health because we're thinking about new ways that we can support students, invest in students. There was a lot of concerns that investments in an all remote world, it's hard to get that engagement and the discussion and the discourse. How important is it to be able to invest in that mental health and the investment, but also doing it here?
Yeah, it is critical. You know, before the pandemic, we had an epidemic of depression and anxiety in young people, starting before college, but really accelerating during those years. And so the pandemic has just added kind of acute insult on top of that. So what we really need, it is an epidemic. What we really need is an approach that is a public health approach for us to understand what's driving this. It's not just the pandemic. What's driving it? How do we prevent it? And how do we best treat it? And some of those interventions are, in fact, going to be online interventions, but some may not be. And there's a need for better connectedness.
Yeah.
How do we do that? So there's a real opportunity here for a very robust research agenda, and it's really in service to the future.
Some of the investments in the future has been women and STEM courses. And I think STEM has been something that we've been throwing around a lot in the last decade, but we haven't really seen sort of the progress that we needed. What are you doing to make sure that women can indeed be included in some of the STEM world?
Well, you know, at Wellesley, we've been so focused on making sure STEM education is part of a liberal arts education, and that all students have the opportunity to thrive in STEM. Part of that is the fact that over 50% of our STEM faculty across the board are women, so they see it, which is phenomenal. But it's also in really bringing in students of all backgrounds, students who are underrepresented, students who may not be from backgrounds where they had been introduced, and really giving them opportunities for deep research experiences. And it's really paying off. 45% of our students are majoring in STEM.
Wow.
We produce the largest number of women PhDs in science, second largest in math compared to our liberal arts peers.
Yeah.
And we just learned that we've gotten the largest number of NSF graduate fellowships. So it can be done, but there really needs to be a focus. And that focus starts in college, starts before college.
Right.
But it has to continue into the workplace.
Talk about some of your peers. We are in Boston. The previous guest is an MIT grad. Everyone here is a Harvard, an MIT, a Wellesley. How do you maintain that competitive edge, cultivate that talent, and make sure that you're still the place where people want to be?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think you have to be your authentic school. And really, every school is not for every student. Understand what it is you cultivate, what your personality is, and the other thing is how you can partner with other schools to be stronger. So for example, we have a very strong partnership with MIT, and that is wonderful for our engineering students. But I think that really understanding deeply your areas of expertise, and then it isn't about the competitiveness, it's really keeping that excellence, keeping in touch with the next generation and moving forward.
Well, you are certainly inspiring this generation. You're inspiring us all here tonight. You're certainly inspiring the next generation of women as well. That was the Wellesley president, Dr. Paula Johnson. Really appreciate it. Technology. I am Taylor Riggs, and we are here at the Boston Convention Center at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce event. I want to get back to the markets. We've talked a lot about a big Bloomberg scoop underway. SpaceX, of course, we know that as Elon Musk's space startup, raising more money and new eye-watering valuations. This is all according to sources. Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow, of course, here. You help break this story. You're always on top of this stuff. What do you have for me?
Yeah, interesting. So sources telling myself, Katie Roof and Gillian Tan, of course, our crack squad of deals reporters, that SpaceX is going through a funding round, right? Raising funds, but at a $125 billion evaluation, according to those sources, right? That is eye-watering for a private U.S. company, for any private company. Two things happening at the same time, really interesting. You have the funding round, raising funds from investors, and at the same time, you have employees selling their private shares. This is quite common for those two things to happen at the same time, a big round, and then for shares to be sold on the secondaries market, an employee tender offer, those employees selling their shares at $70 a share. We don't know the volume of shares are on offer, but you know, this is a company, Taylor, you know, because when you let me, I come on with you, we do the launches for SpaceX, we talk about it for a very long time. This is a company, right? Well, sometimes you let me, because you know that I get carried away, and they're at the cutting edge of space technology. But I think the story here as well, with this rates environment, the Fed, the outlook for inflation, let's bring up the next chart, because it's the jump in valuation that I'm really looking at. When SpaceX raised funds last October, and they also did that secondary sale, we were talking about $100 billion valuation. We're now talking at about $125 billion valuation. I know you've got a really fantastic VC guest coming up where we need to talk about the broader landscape of what's going on here.
Yeah, you're spot on, Ed. Really appreciate it. You're always welcome on my show. So there's my disclaimer. Really appreciate it. Our very own Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow. I want to get back to the markets, and we'll talk about a little bit of the downturn that we've been seeing, especially in the tech startup scene. I'm so pleased to say that Ken Bennett, of course, you know him as partner of Bessemer Ventures, not far from here in Cambridge, dragged out here into the big, big, big city of Boston.
Awesome.
And what Ed was talking about is sort of the valuation, sort of resizing, if you will. And I know that we don't necessarily follow the markets on a day-to-day basis, but to the extent that that volatility impacts your investing, how do you see all that playing out right now?
Yeah, I mean, this is not new. This is not a new place for us. So at Bessemer, a lot of our focus is on cloud stocks, recurring revenue software investing.
Yeah.
And for the last 20 years, for the most part, they've been here. They've been trading at 6 to 10 to 15 times revenue. Smart people can debate, should they be higher, should they be lower? But smart people were not debating last year, should they be at 40 and 50 and 60 times revenue as they were.
Right.
So this feels like a new normal, but it's a place that's familiar for us for the last two decades.
I think it's interesting, though, particularly in the big cloud businesses, the subscription services, the software as a service, the SaaS businesses, that's been sort of a standout where people like the business model. And more importantly, there's a path to profitability. Is a lot of this about companies that have a grow at any cost and are willing or able to turn a profit?
I think the valuations reset has affected every single company in the SaaS index for sure. But absolutely, if you look at the top 10 SaaS companies that we track in the index by market cap, they are all cash flow positive with maybe one exception. They run 20% free cash flow. So these are businesses that have proven their ability to generate cash. And clearly, the businesses that can generate cash are the ones that are being favored a little bit more in this market reset.
I think when we're speaking at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, a lot of the conversations have been about the health of the economy and a lot of the inflationary impacts. What extent, if any, do you have on seeing sort of the macroeconomics on sort of your world of investing and looking at companies?
Yeah. Not many of our companies face a big inflationary dynamic because they're software, so they don't have huge input costs, with the exception of labor. So the talent, the engineering costs have been insane in the last few years. And so what's happening right now is these companies reset, is they all realize they can't raise capital at the cheap prices they used to. And that means they've got to save money somehow. And what that will bring will be layoffs, will be hiring freezes. And we're seeing it in a number of our companies right now. And that means that pretty soon talent, I believe, will be on sale. The cost of engineers, the salaries paid for engineers will absolutely go down.
So maybe a right sizing in the market to some extent. What are you advising CEOs, entrepreneurs of some of the companies within your portfolio about what to do to save that cash, to prepare for a downturn if there is one, and how to like set yourself up for success in the next 12 months?
We're not really saying if at this point. We're telling them it's almost a certainty that we're going into some version of a downturn, especially for them. And so what that means is they should prepare to not raise money as long as they can possibly avoid to not raising money. So there is some private capital still available for these startups, but it is going to be very scared, very nervous, and very hard to come by. So the best startups in the world will be smart enough to not go out into the market for the next at least 18 months, if not 24 and further. So they're all prepared to go that distance. Think about their runway, think about how far they can get without raising any more capital.
Do you then wait to deploy some of the capital if you think valuations or, like you said, talent on sale 12 months from now? How do you deploy that capital?
If 2008, 2009 is any guide, the next year will actually be pretty slow. Even though in theory, the valuations of startups should be lower, the best startups won't be raising unless they're absolutely forced to. And so it'll be a year from now, a year and a half from now, when valuation resets have really filtered through the market, that founders and entrepreneurs will be ready to go back out to the markets. And hopefully for many of them, they'll have grown. So they'll be much more valuable than they are today if they raise anyway in a year. But that's my guess, is that most venture capital will be pretty slow for the next year, and then will begin to pick up as the market slowly comes back to life.
Does that mean more M&A, more consolidation?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's a set of businesses in the world that were never viable and probably shouldn't have been able to raise money. They will go out of business. I think we'll see some very big name liquidations and bankruptcies. There's another set of businesses that are pretty good businesses, but not incredible and don't have enough cash to make it through this timing. And they will all be talking about M&A. They'll be seeking buyers, and the buyers are already sort of licking their lips thinking this might be a time to tuck in a few other companies.
Interesting. Of course, we're here in Boston and we're on the East Coast and we're talking about some of the big tech startups and the innovation. When I was in San Francisco in 2019, it was during the big sort of WeWork debacle, and there was a lot of conversations about unicorns and unicorn status and trying to IPO, and then we got SPACs, and then it was a conversation of how do you go public. What do you see as A, the unicorn status right now, and then B, is a SPAC still a good option?
Yeah, so at Bessemer, we're not talking about SPACs much anymore, and we're not really talking about unicorns. We're talking about what we call centaurs. So focusing on companies that can get to real revenue, $100 million of recurring revenue, we're calling that a centaur, and we think this is the year of the centaur, not the unicorns. I think last year there were something like 500 new unicorns minted. That was like one and a half every single day. That's insane. 10 years ago, it was about four a year were minted. So clearly we went through a unicorn bubble, and the meaning of the term unicorn has been, you know, massively devalued.
And just quickly, here is an IPO that's still one of the best exit strategies.
Absolutely.
Yep. You know,
for companies that can control their own destiny, that can get to that free cash flow positive point, going public is almost always going to have the best return for their capital. It's not easy. It's not for everyone. It can be a real pain to be a public company. But for the companies that have huge markets and massive runway ahead of them, going public will still be a good option. Now, that window may not be open for another year in a viable way for many companies.
Really appreciate it. So smart, lots of good sort of advice and wisdom. Ken Bennett, partner, Bessemer Ventures, really appreciate your insight. And you can read more all about startups in today's Big Take, of course, on Bloomberg, so make sure to check that out. And coming up, we're going to be fixing crypto's environmental problem. Are we? Is it possible? We're going to see how the carbon negative blockchain Algorand is taking a crack at just that. That conversation is next. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
We are here, of course, in Boston at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce annual meeting. It's time now for our crypto report. And beyond the current crypto market volatility, we also want to take a look at another issue that's been plaguing Bitcoin. And it's been a lot of that high energy consumption, which a lot of environmental activists have been calling out. Well, Algorand is a self-sustaining carbon-negative blockchain that aims to create new economic models, all as a sustainable alternative to Bitcoin. Stacey Worden, she's the CEO of Algorand Foundation, and she joins me now. It is so fun to have you here in person at this great event. And I think if there has been a criticism of Bitcoin, it has been the consumption of the energy and the energy it takes to mine the Bitcoin.
Yep.
How did you sort of see that as a problem, and are there actual steps to fix it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we were founded by Sylvia McCauley, who is a Turing Award-winning cryptographer and based in MIT, actually. So here in Boston, yeah. Tenure professor at MIT. And he actually invented a couple of the things that cryptocurrency more broadly as an ecosystem uses. Zero knowledge proofs, verified random functions, that kind of thing. And so he watched the ecosystem develop, and he realized some of these earlier protocols, like Bitcoin, they weren't exactly, they're not fast enough exactly, and they have a large carbon footprint.
Okay.
And they don't scale exactly. So he came up with another consensus mechanism. In blockchain, the whole juice is in the consensus mechanism. So if you want to have a lighter environmental footprint, you need to have a different kind of consensus mechanism.
Okay.
So he came up with a proof of stake consensus mechanism, which has a very light footprint, like seven houses or something.
How do you need that to take off, to be adopted, in order for this sort of narrative to really catch on and become, pun intended, sustainable going forward?
Yeah, no, 100%, because it gets so technical so quickly.
Yeah.
And like things that are new, you don't tend to differentiate among them in the beginning. We think the truth will kind of shake out over time as people get a little bit more aware of the differences and the nuances between the different kinds of layer one chains. And also, we believe that in this world, we need all kinds of different blockchain protocols. So we don't think it's a winner-take-all world at all. But we are very proud of a couple of things about us. So we are very a very scalable blockchain. We do 10,000 transactions per second in July.
Okay.
We have final settlement in 4.5 seconds.
Yeah.
We have a very low carbon footprint and a decentralized blockchain. So, you know, we think we are sort of generation three of blockchains, and
okay,
we're well positioned going forward. Yeah.
We have to talk about, well, maybe generation one, and that's been all of the volatility around crypto and the volatility around Ethereum, and don't even get me started on Terra Luna.
Yeah.
And do you watch all the volatility in those sort of secondary crypto markets? Does it impact your world? What do you make of that?
Yeah, well, sadly for me anyway, this is not my first bear market by any means. I was at the NASDAQ during the dot-com crash. I was at JP Morgan during the global financial crisis. We've had in the cryptocurrency ecosystem a number of different events, right? In 2014, we had Mt. Gox. That was about $500 million. We had the Dow attack or attempted attack in 2016. We had the ICO bust, you know, almost $1 billion went up in kind of coins there. And so the crypto industry continues to recover, and it continues to make itself better because of what it goes through. My heart absolutely goes out to those investors in Terra Luna. I mean, and I have seen a lot in my day, but 56 billion $56 billion is a lot of money for one asset to lose in one asset alone, right? So it's unique for sure.
Well, and that sort of brings up the idea of regulation. And you want regulation to help protect, but you don't want regulation to stifle all of the innovation. And the great experiment that was, and maybe it failed for now, but it was the experiment and the chance at it. How do you stand? Where do you stand on regulation?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very nuanced subject, obviously. And what the industry really does need is regulatory clarity. And I think that when you, Bitcoin Bitcoin, for example, or Ethereum or Algorand, we don't make promises to investors of any kind ever, right? But when you say something and you call it a stable coin,
yeah,
you're kind of saying that you're going to be able to get a dollar if you turn in that coin. You're making a statement, and I think that's where regulators have been focused and are going to continue to focus. And they're going to define, I think, stable coins in a very clear way, and if you don't meet those kinds of specifications, you're probably not going to be able to call yourself one. The most important thing I want to say, though, is that the Algorand blockchain has nothing to do with algorithmic stablecoins.
Right. So good to make clear on that.
Yeah.
On that note, though, when you think about stablecoins, I think you're right. When you hear the word stablecoin, you think stable. Was the bigger issue with Terra Luna that it was backed by an algorithm? It wasn't backed by a dollar peg or even to a blockchain or even to a real asset. For a stablecoin to work, do you need the collateral, if you will, to be actual stable?
Well, you know, what I will tell you is that it was kind of a perpetual motion machine. And perpetual motion machines, I mean, we have been trying to create a perpetual motion machine for centuries, and they do not work. And so it had a baked-in mechanism that if that mechanism starts to fail, then you can have a kind of a death spiral. And so there are more clever financial minds than I that may come up with some way that there is some kind of a future for algorithmic stablecoins, but I don't know. But that kind of a perpetual motion machine type play is not going to be what it looks like.
Well, in the meantime, we're happy to have you here. Of course, Roots in the Boston area as well. Stacey Borden, CEO of the Algorand Foundation, really appreciate your time here and your insights. We are here in Boston, the 2022 Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce annual meeting. It is underway. And well, I hear the Boston Celtics are about to go head-to-head with the Miami Heat for the Eastern Conference Finals. I didn't write that, but I think my producer, Tim Andreacci, made me do that. And take a look at this. You have the DraftKings CEO, co-founder here, Jason Robbins, of course, joining me now. So many conversations about this reopening, how we still think about sports betting in the midst of still getting out of the house, the return of sports. How are you thinking about all of this for your business?
Well, one, it's exciting to see. I mean, look how many people are here. It feels like, things are getting slowly but surely back to normal, and it's just good to see for everybody. I think for us, it helps. More people engaging with sports in more ways is helpful. I think people, given, the mobile device can go anywhere with you, it doesn't really matter to us if you're in a stadium or if you're home. But I think just having more ways for people to engage with sports is good for sports fans. And I think more engagement, this has always been the case, whether it's fantasy or betting, more engagement with fantasy and betting drives more sports content consumption, and more sports content consumption drives more engagement with fantasy and betting.
So it's sort of that circle of life, if you will.
Yes.
I think what's interesting is we've talked a lot about the health of the consumer. We heard from Walmart today that they're not quite able to pass on higher costs to the consumer. Consumers are pulling back and maybe cutting back on the discretionary items and shopping for the necessities. Are you seeing a shift in consumer behavior if they're starting to pull back on some of the fun habits?
Not at all. We have really, really strong cohort data year over year. Gaming is actually known to be very agnostic to different market cycles. Typically, gaming holds up very well during economic downturns. So that's very consistent with what we're seeing. We have a lot of people that love, watching the game. You mentioned tonight's Celtics game, throwing $5 on that. And that's just part of what they do for fun. And that's not changing from anything we're seeing. If anything, we're seeing great year-over-year retention and revenue numbers. So
I want to talk about the income statement and the balance sheet. I'm going to bring you a quote from the Morgan Stanley analyst. Really positive, saying that they think that DraftKings is confident in achieving that near-term EBITDA targets. Talking about this transition, right, to EBITDA profitability in the fourth quarter of 23. And that's been a big focus as we think a lot about the volatility in the tech sector, reevaluation of the valuations and the path to profitability. Is that achievable?
I think absolutely. I mean, I think a lot of where Thomas is getting his information is through really sound analysis based on information we're putting out there.
Yeah.
We've said the same thing, that we think that we're going to be in the fourth quarter, assuming obviously there's a wild card around legalization trends, but assuming normal legalization trends, like consistent with what we've seen the past few years, we think we can get to profitability in the fourth quarter next year.
So to me about that, because we've had you on the program a lot, and we talked a lot about the regulatory environment. We've talked a lot about sort of the general state-by-state legalization environment. How is that environment for you right now? Does the path really indicate future success?
Absolutely. I mean, we've seen a ton of momentum the past few years. This year, we launched New York, Louisiana, Ontario will be very soon. We also have two states in Puerto Rico, so Ohio, Maryland, and Puerto Rico, that are in the process. They've already legalized. They're in the process of writing the regulations, issuing licenses, and getting up and running. At that point, we'll be pretty close to 50% of the U.S. population, and we still have the top three states by population, California, Texas, and Florida, that haven't yet. So those collectively are almost a quarter of the U.S. So still a ton of upside. We're running a ballot referendum in California next year. If we get that, or this year, I should say, sorry, in November.
Right.
If we get that done, that's another 12-13% of the population. So really seems like the momentum's strong.
So you talked about the three big states as maybe the big golden goose to attack. Should we infer from those comments that the biggest opportunity still remains here in the U.S.? I know you mentioned Ontario a little bit. How do you think about that?
We think Canada is a great opportunity, too. I mean, certainly the U.S. is where we feel, because there's more population, that our bigger opportunity is. But Ontario, if it were a state, would be the fifth largest state in the U.S. by population. So it's basically equivalent to getting like a, you know, Illinois-sized state, Pennsylvania-sized state to come online. So that's really a big deal for us.
Really appreciate it, DraftKings CEO Jason Robbins. Go bet on that game. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And of course, that does it here for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. We will be back in San Francisco tomorrow, but we had a great time here, of course, at the Boston Convention Center and at the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce annual meeting. Stick with us. This was fun. We should do this more often. This is Bloomberg.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.